I said, "Brother, maybe it's just me, you know, but and I know that I haven't been teaching a lot of preterism, you know, per se to you guys. A little bit here and there since I've been back. You know, the big guns haven't been out for quite a while, you know, sort of a thing. And I part of my thing is like, I don't know, you know, my books that are out there and the CDs, they cover a lot of things, but we get orders mostly for the Second Coming series, Book of Revelation, you know, that kind of stuff. And it kind of gets on my head a little bit, and I think, you know, I don't want to be, you know, like a, you know, a one-wheel cart, you know, kind of a thing. I've never wanted to be it. And I think even as I talk about it, you would probably say back to me, well, no, you're not. You know, you give us a lot of different things, you know, and I want to be that way. I don't like those type of ministries that open up, you know, they're kind of parachurchy, and they're focused on, you know, one subject, you know, in Scripture, eschatology, you know, and that's not the thing. However, on the other hand, I bet if we did a little eschatological preterist survey right now, I wonder how much of us would pass. I'm just saying, you know, I forget things. I have to keep reminding. You know, Keith and I talk about this too. Just this past week, you know, I heard Keith say some things to me this week, and he gave me some scriptures, you know, this morning, and I'm going, okay, I forgot that that was there. And I think to myself, you know, if somebody was to ask me, well, Pastor, you know, Philippians 1:10, you know what I mean? And I'm going, No, I got to flip to it, you know, because I don't remember, see? So if what I do remember is because I'm in the Word every day, you know, and I'm going over it and over it and over it. I'm going through my devotions, the book of, yeah, we'll get to Mark in a second, I'm talking. I mean, part of my devotions right now is in the book of Revelation, you know, which I tend to not spend a lot of time in, you know, because I'm like, I've been inundated with this stuff for so long. But here we go again. You know, the Lord slapped me up the head, and I'm seeing stuff I didn't see before, you know? And I used to say, and you'll remember I've said this, now, Book of Revelation is not the book you go to learn Bible doctrine, and I still hold that. But you know what we've got in Revelation? We've got, through the means of type, shadow, and signs, all kinds of New Testament doctrine. Justification by faith is in there. And the deity of Christ, the nature of the Godhead, the Trinity. There are so many things that are in there. And I'm just going, oh, Lord, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Lord, I see it. I repent, you know, that old kind of a thing. So life with God is an adventure. And it's a good thing. We're in the 12th chapter of Mark. Certainly you've arrived there right now because I have babbled to give you time to get you there. 12th chapter of Mark. If you will recall, last time we were here, we did the first 11 verses, or really the 12 12 verses of the 12th chapter of Mark, and we talked about this terrible parable. Jesus is coming down strong on the hypocrisy of the Jewish leadership. No one is safe from his gaze. We've got the Pharisees lined up in his sights. We've got who are essentially the majority rule spiritually, theologically, religiously within the state of Israel at this time. Then we have the Sadducees, who have the political muscle. They're in bed with Rome. And so Rome places priests within, I mean, the whole thing is really fleshy, places priests within the work of the temple, the sacrificial system, who are Sadducean, you see. Caiaphas, Annas, you know, who took charge of the false proceedings against Christ in regards to his mock trial. They were both Sadducees, you see. And these are guys that didn't believe in the resurrection. You know, they didn't hold all, they would be considered, you know, the liberals, you know, sort of spiritually speaking of Jesus' day. They denied the resurrection. You know, they denied a lot of things because basically they only accepted the first five books of Moses and everything else was just sort of optional, not so important, you know. Well, of course they don't, you know, believe a lot of things because they're not believing what the Word has to say in what God has given, you see. And we're going to see Jesus come down on them for that today. There are the Herodians. We're going to get to see them in action a little bit today. These are guys that are politically allied to the family and dynasty of Herod, King Herod, the Herodian dynasty, put there under Rome, by the way, and by Rome. And they find that, you know, it's beneficial to them if they are involved politically, you know, with them. Their spiritual stuff is not so important. You know, they could be like all over the map, but they want to make sure that they're getting their piece of the pie and they're protected by being hooked up, you know, with the leadership that is in force and in play at that time. And we have other groups that are going on. As Jesus gives this parable, it's a denunciation against the God's vineyard of Israel. It's a denunciation saying that you have cast out, you've stolen the land, you've taken the blessings of God. You remember we went over all this? And that God has sent His prophets again and again and again, and you have hurt them, stoned them, you have killed them, you have cast them out. Finally, God sends His Son. He says, I'll send my one and only Son whom I love, and they'll reverence my Son. And what happened? They made a plan to murder Him. They said, look, this is the Son. Let's kill Him, and the inheritance will be ours. Nobody will be able to stand, you know, against us. We'll just take what's there, because nobody else is going to inherit it. Once the old man dies, you know, this is their thinking in regards to the parable. But there's a deeper spiritual truth behind all of this as well, which very little of them ever got. All they were able to discern is that Jesus then teaches this parable, tells them then, what's God going to do? What's the owner of the vineyard going to do? He's going to come, and He's going to send His armies and wipe out the vineyard, and God will deal with them. And the stone that the builders have rejected will crush them to dust. And this is the context that we're dealing with right now. It is Passover week here in our study. It is Passover week. Jesus is days away from the cross. Days away from bearing our sins in His body on the tree. Just days away. Jesus, throughout His ministry, we've seen it several times where there have been opportunities that other groups, the Sadducees, maybe the Pharisees, maybe the scribes, you know, those are the experts in the law, they're always copying the law, some of the priests, where they're trying to kill Him. We've seen from the beginning of Jesus' ministry, He gets out of their way. He doesn't, you know, presumptuously stand in the highway and let the Mack truck run Him down. He gets out of the way. See? He does this on several occasions. Now, during Passover week, He's doing everything He can to take the sharp stick of the Word and jab that rattlesnake. The big bear, you know, in the woods. This is Jesus, you know? Yeah. In other words, what's He doing? Time for me to die. Time for me to fulfill prophecy. Time for me to fulfill Psalm 22. To be on the cross. To let them nail me to the cross. To let my thirst go. To let my body be parched and drained of its blood. To have my beard ripped off. Psalm or Isaiah 50, Isaiah 52, Isaiah 53. Time for me to bear the iniquities of the many. Time for me to let them put me on that cross, drop it in the ground. I want all my bones go out of joint. Time to fulfill these things. Time for me to fulfill the prophecy of Jonah. 3 days, 3 nights in the belly of the whale. So shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Time for Psalm 16 and verse 10 to be fulfilled. Thou wilt not leave my soul in hell, neither wilt thou let thy Holy One suffer corruption. Time to be raised. Time to lead. Time to give absolutes to all mankind. Not give them a choice. Make a declaration of who God is through Christ. This is the week. This is the tension that is taking place. As Jesus has to deal, one more time, with the Sadducees, with the Pharisees, and with the Herodians. How He has to put up with their unbelieving crap. The leaders, spiritual leaders, of the people of Israel, who have rejected Him, rejected Him, rejected Him. And now, He's confronting them. He knows they have power. He knows that they can get Him onto that cross. He knows that they have power and pull with the Roman magistrate, which in this case is Pilate. And that as Jesus continues down this road, and these men with their evil intent who have been, we've seen it time and time again in Mark's gospel, they're planning, they're making a plan to kill him. They're making a plan to kill him, and they're looking for this thing to happen. And they're trying to find the best way to do it so that they are basically have their hands washed and it's really not their responsibility. And they're just doing their job by delivering this, you know, this treasonous blasphemer up to Pilate. See? They got, the plan is forming right now. And Jesus doesn't want this to slow down because it's Passover. It's time for the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world to actually be slain in linear time. And he's poking the snake. Oh, man. Is he not a man's man? You know, words like, I mean, we use, you know, descriptors, tough, you know, whatever, bold, whatever your descriptor is, doesn't really cover it. He's like above and beyond. Mark 12, verse 13. And they send unto him certain of the Pharisees and of the Herodians to catch him in his words. And when they were come, they say unto him, Master, we know that thou art true, carest for no man, for thou regardest not the person of men, but teachest the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not? Shall we give or shall we not give? But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said unto them, Why tempt ye me? Bring me a denarius, that I may see it. And they brought it. And he saith unto them, Whose is this image and superscription? And they said unto him, Caesar's. Jesus answering said to them, Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they marveled at him. Oh my gosh. What a confrontation. What brilliance in this answer. Could you have come up with a response like this? We'll talk about what the heck that the Pharisees and the Herodians were trying to pull, you know. There's always a method to this madness of the scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, Herodians, so on and so forth. Whenever they come up, I mean, they're not idiots. You know, they think things through. They're making plans. They're good. Jesus is better. So it always fails. And Jesus is always turning the issue on its head. And it always demonstrates, in this case, the hypocrisy of these people who are trying to lead the rest of Israel. And they always do it publicly so that everybody gets to see. Jesus does not hold back. Does not hold back. To those who are committed to his downfall, Jesus lets them have it right between the eyes. Tender Jesus, meek and mild, little lamby pie around the shoulders, I've never seen it. Never seen it. But I've seen mercy and love and tenderness beyond anything to those who come to him in faith. And on the other hand, I see the most definite, unmistakable, irrepressible judgment and judgment acts of pure judgment that come from Jesus' mouth upon those to whom it is due. Wow. Kind of mirrors the judgment itself, the eschatological judgment. Kind of mirrors that. Look at 13. And they send unto him certain of the Pharisees. Now the they here are the ones he just got through giving the original parable to, chapter 12, verses 1 through 12. Those people are defined back in chapter 11, verse 27, as the chief priests, scribes, and elders. Chief priests, now right away, that means are they Pharisees or are they Sadducees? Chief priests. Pharisees or Sadducees? That's right. They're Sadducees, because the Sadducees had the hand of Rome, and they were the ones that were put in those positions, okay? There were no Pharisee priests, okay? Scribes. Who are the scribes? Scribes are the ones who copied down the law. They were considered lawyers. They were considered experts in the law. See, in the lawyer situation. So you got scribes. You got chief priests. And you got elders. Now, the elders in Israel were the older, respected men. They don't think of elders in the church, the presbyteroi or anything like that, in regards to our function in our church, Keith and myself. These were the old, wiser men who did have positions of authority in various places. They were probably even members of the Sanhedrin and things like that, but on a very low level. And so it is these who are being referred to in chapter 12, verse 13, when it says, they send unto him certain of the Pharisees and Herodians. Now, this is hilarious. It's amazing how certain strange bedfellows sort of take place. That's probably a term that doesn't even mean anything in our society anymore. You know, I don't use it. You probably don't either. But I'll put it to you this way. How interesting when two opposing groups of people with different religious views, different philosophies, will polarize and come together and gather themselves together around a common enemy. Because that's what you got here. You got the Pharisees. Who are, I've told you before, pretty much, you know, the religious fundamentalists in Judaism, you know? They're the ones that believed all the Bible that was given up to this point. So all the Old Covenant, see, all 39 books in the old, they believed it was all inspired, you know, binding upon them. How they interpreted it was a whole nother animal. And that's what Jesus has to rebuke in the sermon in regards to Matthew 5 through 7, Matthew chapter 5 through 7 in regards to that Sermon on the Mount situation. All right, but they're basically the fundamentals, and they push, man, the resurrection. Jesus, it could basically be said that in the Gospels, when it comes to the subject of the doctrine of the resurrection, Jesus pretty much would have sided with them, but not entirely. We'll talk about that a little later. Maybe today, maybe not till next week. So there's that going on. They believe in that. You know, they're the fundamentals. Okay. Then you've got these Herodians right here, which I've already explained to you were in the political machinations, making sure that the dynasty of Herod continued. They like that. It's sort of like I always want like a Republican, you know, in the White House, or a Republican, you know, generated and controlled Congress or something like that. So these were the Herodians. They had picked their man and their family. They were committed to that, you know. The religious thing, oh man, they were flaky. They could go in a number of directions, okay? But really, the Pharisees hated the Herodians. The Herodians thought, you know, the Pharisees just a bunch of puffed up, bunch of numbnuts, you know, kind of a routine. So these guys come together. The Pharisees and the Herodians come together, their total theological and social cultural enemies, to do one thing, bottom of 13, to catch him in his words. Agruo is the Greek for catch. Agruo. It is a word that means I'm going to go trap, hunt down, and trap an animal. Agruo. Gives you a perspective in regards to what they thought of Jesus. He's an animal to be hunted down, to be caught, and to be trapped. Whew. This is their attitude coming to Jesus with. Which makes their hypocrisy and what they're about to say to him in verse 14 amazing. Look at 14. And when they were come to Jesus, they said unto him, Master, Kiyash, Master, we know that thou art true. Okay, stop! Didaskale is our Greek teacher, sometimes translated the King James as master. But they said to him, Teacher, we know that you are true. All right, bearing false witness right out the gate. Number one, he was not their teacher. They wouldn't have him for their teacher if it cost them their lives. And it did. But in any case, he's not our teacher. And they certainly didn't believe this. We know that thou art true. If you do, then repent, support what Christ is doing, walk away from your hypocrisy and your insanity and your enslavement over the Jewish people of Israel, and take up your cross and follow him. Don't give me any of this lip service. We know that you are true. It's like people you talk to out on the street. Most of them will say, you know, well, yeah, I believe in Jesus. Or, yeah, I believe in God. Or, you know, you talk to people who are in churches today. Yeah, I believe in Jesus. What the flip does that mean? I believe in Jesus. There's a lot of people who believe in Jesus. What is it that they believe? And where is that belief originating from? If it's originating from in here, then I'm going to hell. Because not all men have faith, because saving faith is what? It's a gift of God. So is repentance. See? People say, I believe in Jesus. Master, teacher, we know that you are true and carest for no man, for thou regardest not the person of men, but teachest the way of God in truth. In other words, you're not a respecter of persons, you know, kind of a thing. And what are they doing? It's an ego stroke. They're manipulating him. They're mentally manipulating Jesus. They're trying to set him up. You think it's working? This is God. This is God standing right there. And everybody else knew, oh, this is the biggest load of baloney I ever... Everybody else knew. Jesus had been, he's better than 3 years. Close to 3.5 years he's been ministering. All up and down. Now, not a large swath. I mean, he wasn't traveling all over Asia or something. You know, he was within, you know, like a 400-mile radius kind of a thing. But he was up and down, you know, the coast, up into Galilee, up into Syria, you know, down. Everybody knew. And then the area of Jerusalem, everybody knew this was nonsense. But they're stroking him. See, what's amazing to me is they think that they can pull this off. Is there nothing worse than somebody who stands up and does their thing, and you're kind of starting to feel embarrassed for them. You know what I'm saying? It's like, how can he not? And everybody's looking at each other, and eyes are rolling, you know? No doubt that's what was happening in the crowd, is the crowd's listening. Now, they wouldn't do it in front of the Pharisees, because that could seriously hurt them. But it's like, lots of oy veying going on that day. All right. But teaches the way of God in truth. So they're setting him up, and here comes the question. Man, leveling the shotgun. Here we go. I got to tell you, it's like the shotgun, they turned it around, they pointed it at themselves, and they got their thumb on the trigger, you know, routine. Is it lawful, so this is a law question, Mosaic law question. Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not? Shall we give or shall we not give? Now, these guys just really think a lot of themselves. They think very highly of themselves. They actually think that they've got Jesus on the horns of the insoluble dilemma. They think it doesn't matter what he says. We've got him. He's going to be burned like toast in just a moment here. Man, why didn't we scribe, you know, Pharisees and Herodians, man, why didn't we think about getting together before? Man, we could have snuffed him along. What's he going to do with this? You know? See, here's the background of this question. Here's the dynamic that was going on in Israel at that time. Number one, it's the question of, should we pay our taxes? Giving tribute. It's a reference to pitting the law of Moses against the political machinery and rule of Rome, which is a very real threat. So, here's what they're doing. If Jesus says, you shouldn't give, you shouldn't pay tribute, then what could the Pharisees have done? They could have gone and accused him of treason before Pilate. They could have set him up as somebody who was leading a revolt against Rome by gathering people. It would have implied an army, an armed revolt. And by the way, they did in fact include that in the charges when they got Jesus in front of Pilate. They did include that. To a lesser degree, because they couldn't really support it too much, you know. There was nobody who was witnessing, or everybody was false witness. It was ridiculous. But in any case, this is the idea. If he said, don't pay your taxes, then they could have brought him up on charges of treason, and then they get rid of him. Because then Rome would have been forced to act and take hold of this guy and either put him to death or something, got him out of the way, got him out of their yard. So that would have worked for me. See, it's like that. On the other hand, if Jesus would have said, no, you should pay tribute, pay your taxes. Remember I've told you about the tax men at that time during the New Testament? There were usually all of them Jewish men who had essentially sold their soul to Rome. And they were the most hated, despised people. Nobody had more people spit more venom of hatred and despising than upon the tax collector. because you know what the tax collectors did. They were in charge by Rome to collect a certain percentage. It was different for the different locales, see? And they were responsible to get that percentage back to Rome, you know, get it into the Roman coffers, keep the machinery going. But the way that the tax man, the tax collector was paid, was that he was able, and Rome knew it was happening. It wasn't official policy, but basically it was one of those look the other way kind of things. They allowed the tax collectors to just tack on just almost any kind of surcharge fee that they wanted to, and they put it in their pocket. So one time it might be 30%. The next time it might be 45%. The sky's the limit. You know why? They could charge whatever they wanted because they had the authority of Rome backing them. Sound like what's happening today? See? Reaching into the pocket. Okay. I'm disciplining myself right now. You already know what I'm saying and what I mean. We'll stay in the text. Okay, so either way, yeah, the Pharisees and the Herodians, we got him! You're like, either way, he's toast. Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not? Shall we give or shall we not give? Middle 15. But he, Jesus, knowing their hypocrisy. Stop. See, that's the problem. That's why we never get away with anything. Jesus knows. Jesus knows. Brother, could I ask you to go flip on that AC? I can feel it up here. Yeah. So, better to freeze than to sleep while I'm preaching. This is the problem. Jesus knows the condition of our heart. He knows the hypocrisy. What's a hypocrite? It's one who wears the mask. Upokritos. I've told you this before. It's a reference to an actor in a Greek play who wears the mask and he pretends to be somebody that he isn't. See? The hypocrite, and Jesus in Matthew 22, and he's getting ready to do it here, it's going to happen pretty quick, is going to take that sharp stick of the word, and he's going to stick that sleeping bear, as it were, and it's rousing now. In Matthew 22, 8 times, he says to the Pharisees and the scribes, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, play actors, not the genuine God-called leaders that you pretend to be, making slaves out of the people of Israel, twisting and turning and rending the Old Testament words of God to your own selfish ends, so that you can lead these people, have authority over them, and get your living and your livelihood off of them." You know, that's men. You know, it's not about money. It's not. Money is just a symbol of power. Mike and Chris and Carrie and I were talking about this just the other night. Money's just a symbol of power. That's all it is. And that's what the Pharisees wanted. They just wanted power over the people. That was the entire situation right here. And so Jesus comes to them. Now they ask this question, verse 15, but he, knowing their hypocrisy, said unto them, watch this question, "Why tempt ye me? Bring me a denarius that I may see it." Notice the question first. It's a twofold question. First question is what? Yeah. Why are you tempting me? Peirazo is our Greek word. Why are you testing me? Why are you testing me? Now, who's saying this? Jesus is saying it. What is the biblical impact behind Jesus saying this question? Okay, I'm hearing it. You guys are great. Yeah. What? You're all quoting Deuteronomy 6:16 to me. You do not put the Lord your God to the test. You do not tempt the Lord your God. Jesus is not a stranger to this phrase. He's used it before. Can you think of another place in the New Testament, in the Gospels, where Jesus said, you don't put the Lord your God to the test? What was the occasion? Yeah, the temptation in the wilderness, exactly. What was Jesus implying about his own personhood when he said to Satan, "You will," who was doing what? Who was trying to tempt him right then. And he quotes back, "You don't put the Lord your God to the test." What is Jesus saying about himself? He's God. He's God. Now Jesus comes. You hypocrites, why tempt ye me? In other words, what is he saying? He's saying, I'm God. I'm God. How dare you do this to me? It wasn't lost on the Jewish audience either, because they were very familiar with that Deuteronomy 6:16 phrase. So he says, why tempt ye me? Bring me, King James says, a penny. It's darion. It's a denarius. That I may see it. Now, this is fascinating. Keep in mind now the hypocrisy charge that's going on here, right? Okay, watch this. Bring me a denarius that I may see it. Now, in the Jewish economy, there was Roman coinage. They had the ability to exchange it for Jewish minted coins, which the Romans allowed them to do. And we've got lots of archaeological evidence of Jewish coins that were minted prior to the first century, for instance. Very fascinating stuff. The Jewish coins, you know, usually had some reference to David, you know, King David is a reference to the Messiah, something along this line, maybe a palm tree on one side, you know, and it always had Old Covenant references, you know, to it. But one thing you would never find on a Jewish coin was a what? Yeah, you wouldn't find Caesar, and you sure wouldn't find the picture of some guy. And you wouldn't find the picture, you know, of, certainly not of God, you know. Why is that? Because the first commandment, yeah, baby, yeah, nobody's seen him. First commandment and the second commandment, I am the Lord your God, identifies him through his name. You don't make an image of me. Which the Jews, especially the Pharisees, understood to be, you don't make an image at all. So you will find, you know, I mean, a complete dearth of any kind of human artwork, you know, within the confines of Jerusalem, unless it was from some other time of compromise or something like that. Okay, but at this time, it was the Pharisees were ruling over. So here's the deal. Jesus says, all right, this is fine. Bring me a denarius. Now, a denarius represented a day's wages. So this is like paycheck for the day, okay? So bring me a denarius. On one side of the Roman denarius, there was a picture of Tiberius Caesar, because he was the Caesar at that point. Picture of Tiberius. On the other side of the denarius was a reference to Tiberius being of the lineage of deity, son of deity. And it also made a reference to him as being high priest, which is why Rome, as the ruling power, went ahead and took steps to assign who would be the priest and the high priest within the functions of the temple. And the Sadducees played into that, lots of butt-gizzing, played into this, and they got where they were politically and had that kind of power. All right, so here are these good Jewish folks who are supposed to be holding up Ten Commandments, first two commandments in particular. By the way, it was socially looked down to have this currency on you. You with me now? Got this picture? Watch this. Oh my gosh. Bring me a denarius that I may see it. 16, and they brought it. And he saith unto them, whose is this image and superscription? And they said unto him, Caesar's. Now wait just a second. 16 at the top, and they brought it. Who's the they? Who's he talking to? Pharisees and Herodians, right? And they brought it, Pharaoh, not Pharaoh, king of Egypt, but it's the way the word is pronounced in Greek, for to bear. And it's been vulgarized into brought in our English translation, okay? But the Greek reads that the Pharisees and Herodians bore it. They had it on them. They had it on them. Jesus, these dummies, Jesus outs them by playing their game. Brilliant. Outs them by playing their game. We got him. We got him. He's not going to get out of this. All right. Bring me a denarius. Who's got one? Well, I got one. All of them start reaching into their purses and their pockets, right? Pulling this stuff out. And then all people are looking like, holy cow. It's like, stand away from these guys before the lightning strikes, you know? They're all walking around with images with superscriptions on them that speak about how that this man is divine and is the high priest. They pull one out and they bear it to him. Jesus doesn't even speak to that. You know why? He doesn't have to. Their actions have just betrayed their hypocrisy. You see, you and I can't get away with anything, can we? We can't get away. When you think you're getting away with it, that's when you absolutely are not. We're learning about this in adult Sunday school class in regards to Jacob. And Jacob's getting the way beat out of him right now. What goes around comes around. He is hastening to the chastening. That was the title from the teaching this morning. He thinks he's getting away with it. He thinks he's stolen Esau's birthright, you know. He thinks that he's gotten away with the deception and the lie that he put forth towards his father with the help of his mother. And he's going to go see Uncle Laban in Haran. And he's going to be with them. He's going to be with them for a dozen or better years. And Uncle Laban is going to just, yeah. So they're outing themselves right in front of Jesus and right in front of all the people. So whose image, middle of 16, is this image and superscription? They said unto him, Caesar's. The confession of their mouth is Caesar's, which, by the way, was close to their heart, because in front of Pilate, the Roman representative, all these priests and the Sanhedrin representatives, the Council of 70, are going to say to him, we have no king but Caesar. Denying, reaching, embracing, digging deep into the bosom of idolatry and unfaithfulness, and drawing the rotting carcass of that which we substitute for God, bringing it close to us. Pulling it in, breathing in its aroma, and then we say, we're Christians! As we suck in the very oxygen of hell into our lives. And they said unto him, Caesar's. It's Caesar's. Now here comes this brilliant verse 17. And Jesus answering, said unto them, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they marveled at him. You know, we're so used to certain phrases, right, in the Bible as being very familiar. Please don't miss out on the impact of what I'm about to tell you, because this is the last verse I'm doing. Don't be happy. I can stretch this puppy out for hours. No. I just don't want, you know, this is something I want to emphasize because I don't want you to miss out on any of this. Don't start thinking, well, I know this, you know, let's just kind of get it over with. Not that you would think that. If you weren't, you are now, I guess, because I just gave it to you. Jesus answered, said unto them, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Apodidomai. Literally, return. To give back. To make a return, okay? So he's saying, give back to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Stop right there for a moment, okay? Stop right there. Now, Jesus' words cannot be mistaken here. The people were being taxed to death. Jesus is saying, I'm your source, I'm your supply. Jesus is saying that, don't look to the government, don't look to men to supply your needs. See? If the government is asking for 20%, give it. If it's asking for 30%, give it. Now, Jesus is not suggesting here, because the rest of the Bible would be against this. Jesus is not suggesting here, that's okay, let a tyrannical leader raise up, you know, and just beat the way out of you and just shake you out, you know, for all that you've got, let him take 80% and basically, you know, you and your family are starving or something like that. The phrase for that is called communism. And socialism is the first step towards communism. Please understand that those are two different systems. They're not the same. We are at present a socialist government. I'm leaning, I know. We're at present a socialist government. We're on our way to communism. I may return to that. But according to Romans 13 and verse 7, Paul talks about in Romans 13 and in the context surrounding verse 7, he talks about how that those who are in positions of leadership and authority, politically, governmentally, are set there by God. They've been placed there by God. And we're to submit to them in regards to that as unto God. Now, the fascinating thing about that statement is who was on the throne of Rome, who was the Caesar when Paul wrote the epistle to the Romans? Nero. And if you've done any reading and you know anything about Nero, you've sat through any of my Revelation stuff, because I have to bring him up in Revelation, you know that this was got to be one of the most outrageous, foul, demented, whacked out, lascivious men that ever walked the planet or drew breath at any one time. You know? I mean, kicking his pregnant wife to death on the floor. Arranging for all kinds of little boys to come and do sexual favors for him on a regular basis. When Christianity became religio illicit, an illicit religion, he would take them and he would have within the outer square of his house where he would throw these outrageous orgies and bodies and flesh intertwined, and he would light them up with the night sky. He would use the bodies of Christians soaked in pitch on spits all the way around to give light so you could see the orgies. And these people are dying for their faith in a horrible, horrendous way. And there are other ridiculous, gross and disgusting things that he did on a regular basis. And Paul says, pay your taxes. Romans 13, 7. Tribute to whom tribute is due. That's tax. Honor to whom honor is due. Some modern translations just say, pay your taxes. Well, that's correct. That's correct. Okay. The Bible does not forbid the civil overthrow of a government. The Bible lets people know that while God has placed individuals in power, it's not for without a reason. The reason we have the man that's in the White House right now is it's a direct... What do you think? He just kind of put himself there? Did he just decide, you know, I'm going to be president? No. The majority vote along with the college, the Electoral College, and it's important to understand how that works. It's not... Nobody gets into the White House because the majority voted for him. They have to get votes based upon... the representatives of the different states, when tabulating the total amounts of votes, then they get certain amounts of points, which are placed by the Electoral College into the slot of the individual who's running. And it's at the end, it's the majority vote that represents, or I should say, it's the Electoral College that represents the majority will of the people. But it allows for no abuse for certain states, like Rhode Island is pretty tiny, but California is ridiculous. You know, in regards to the population, it's a way to balance things out, see? And it works good. But the result does represent the will of the majority of the people. But that has to go that way, okay? The man is in the White House, and we have the government and the laws that have been set into place because the spiritual health of the people of the United States of America reflects it. So I believe in pay back, render, return unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. If I asked you all to pull a dollar bill out of your wallets or out of your purses right now, and we took a good look at it, I mean, I don't do that too much. None of us really do, you know. The money's just in our pockets, you know, we don't really, you know. But on one side, depending upon the denomination of the bill, you got a picture of a president. You would have never had that in ancient Israel, unless, you know, under the circumstances I've described them, okay? You got a picture on one side. You know, on the other side, you got things like In God We Trust, and you've got a pyramid with the all-seeing eye on top. That is rooted in so much blasphemous paganism. It's a result of the Masonic intervention within the history of some of the leaders of this country. But it's highly ungodly. The reality is that eye represents Satan. Now, other people have other opinions. But it's my conclusion that that's what it essentially means. Got the picture on one side, and then it's the other side. It says, in God we trust. If the all-seeing eye is a representative of Satan, and on the other hand it says, in God we trust, who are they saying is God? See, don't be silly and naive in regards to, you know, one nation under God. Please, 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 please. The powers that be that underlie the power base politically and the banking system and the Rothschilds and the family-owned system within our country are corrupt and lascivious. They've always been there. A man like Obama or Clinton, for that matter, I mean, basically not in power positions, are assisted into these positions and placed before the American public. Sure, you have a choice. Yes, you need to be discerning. And I think that even those people that voted for him, or many of them are very sorry they did that. Many of them never thought they would see him do the things that he has done. And I'm not going to do a litany of all of his stuff right now, okay? Now, I don't mind telling you, you know, that on the one hand, I do recognize that God has placed him there, but he's there as a judgment to this country. God is giving them what they want. Now, I got plenty of Bible to back that up. God's giving them what they actually want and what they deserve. Remember when they screamed at Samuel, you know, in 1 Samuel, give us a king, give us a king. Remember that? Samuel went to God, blah, blah, blah. And God says, hey, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. Do what they want. Go ahead, do what they want. He gave them what they wanted. Gave them one of the worst kings ever, Saul, son of Benjamin. Or Cis, I'm sorry. Horrible, horror story. Ruled for 40 years, it was a disaster. Ended up committing suicide. Now in our country, while on the one hand we're rendering what is due unto Caesar, the Bible does not say, hey, if they start abusing you, there's nothing you can do about it. You're just going to have to just relax, just do it as unto God. I'm sorry. Ready for a new Bible study? There is biblical grounds for a righteous revolt. Why do you think this country came into existence? We were revolting against the tyranny, taxation, abuse, and non-representative government of England over the 13 colonies. I don't care what people say. I mean, I know reformed people who say, oh, yeah, no, they should have never. England was our sovereign, you know, Romans 13, you know, it's like, what is this? You know, what is this? You see, and I'll tell you something else that make you go at Pastor Burks, you know. I'm a conspiratorialist. Now, when I say that, I don't mean I buy every nutcase that's out there, you know, but I'm saying there's a grain of truth behind a lot of these conspiracies. And I think the conspiracies are given lots of muscle and lots of play and lots of airing out by those in power who want you to think it's a conspiracy, so you will go, oh, idiocy, turn away and let them do their thing unhindered. Maybe Pastor reads too many novels. Maybe Hollywood is influencing. Or maybe I read things like Tragedy and Hope. Ever heard of it? Larry, you would like that book. What? I'll loan it to you, man. It's about yay thick. It's great bedtime material. Okay? Fascinating, by a fellow named Quigley. I read stuff that other people don't have. So it doesn't surprise me that you've never heard of that. You know, it's not, you'll never go down to parables and find it. In fact, you'll never find much anything good at parables. Oh, sorry. Shouldn't have said that. I just cut their investments down by saying that. I think there is a place. I think there is a biblical place and a righteous place for the overthrow of tyranny, not to mention the fact that the Constitution tells us that it is, as American citizens, our duty to overthrow a tyrannical government. We are at the doorstep. Now, I say, do it through all the legal applications that you can first. And when those things run out, when your back is still against the wall, when the government's pocket, big government, is, or rather, the government's hand is in your pocket, We're heading out of the socialist situation. This healthcare plan, now I'm going to say it. This health care plan will lead us to communism. It will lead us to governmental dependence like crazy. Businesses will be forced out. Forget monopolies. There won't be any monopolies anymore because there'll be no strong businesses. And the average middle business or small business, because of the taxes you have to pay, is going to go under and go out of business. And that's going to increase the dependency on the dole in our country. It's going to increase dependency on government. That is the point. And you'll only get that from a democratic ruled Congress and presidency. Now, I'm not saying the Republicans are rah-rah and they're righteous. They are definitely the lesser of two evils. We can slow this thing down, you know, by, and so I say to you, the man rules in the presidency illegitimately. He is not a citizen. I'm absolutely convinced. You need to do your homework about this. You need to read a lot about this. Check everything out. 1.7 million dollars he spent on legal fees to keep his so-called birth certificate wrapped up. Easy. This is easy. You know, I know I'm doing this to you. Spiritual food. Here we go. Okay. And Jesus answering said unto them, return unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Now I love this second part, and I'll end with this. And to God the things that are God. Literally, in the Greek, and the things of God to God. He's implying that the money is not something that God cares about relative to what belongs to him. But the Pharisees, see, and the Herodians were like all about the money. In fact, Luke's gospel says the Pharisees were lovers of money. Literally, lovers of silver. Same thing, okay? And he's saying, look, man, whew, you know, give Caesar what he wants. Don't be hung up by that. Don't be hung up. Don't let it take up all your thoughts and all your time. See, now I would tell you on the other side of the coin here, don't let our political thing here in America hang you up. Don't let it suck up a bunch of your mental and emotional time. Don't let it happen. Think on the Lord. Whatsoever things are good, whatsoever things are honorable, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are delightsome, whatsoever, think on these things, and the God of peace will be with you. Not think on your political blah, 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 and on the websites, you know, all day long, and, oh, outrage, you know, kind of a thing. You know what? More time in the Word. The food. The oxygen of heaven. The manna of our Messiah. This is it. This is it. Forever, O Lord, thy word is settled in heaven. O God, let it be settled in my heart. My prayer. Give back to Caesar the things that are Caesar and the things of God to God. Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Let the world have what it wants is what he's saying. Now, there's a balance point. I've already addressed it. Let me just go on. Let the world have its world's thing. Focus on God. Instead of being hung up about where the money's going, where the taxes are, blah, 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 blah. How about spending at least an equal amount of time relative to the Word, relative to the things of God? Because the people, look at their reaction, bottom of verse 17, and they what at him? They marveled at him. Ethaumazo in Greek. They dropped the jaw in wonder and amazement at what he was saying. And Jesus is glorified. Men come up to Jesus to try to prove him to be somebody that they want others to believe that he is. Jesus turns it around, demonstrates to the people exactly what they were doing. You think they were happy about that? Think the Pharisees and the Herodians were happy about that? As he pokes the sleeping bear, he's saying, get me to the cross. Get me to the cross. Now, if you read about a guy on news that was constantly trying to get people to kill him, and finally somebody obliged him, you say, what about the guy? Poor guy, he's just sick in the head. Guy was crazy. Is that who Jesus is? Was Jesus crazy? Is that what he was doing? Was he a lunatic? Was he insane? Trying to get people to kill him? See what I'm saying? Well, if he's not, then that leaves you only with one other conclusion about Jesus. He was exactly who he said he was. He was the Holy Son of God, born of a virgin, conceived by a virgin, but born from her, okay? He was sinless. He was perfect and is perfect. He was crucified for the sins of the elect, raised on the third day, is seated at the right hand of the Father. That's a typological Hebraic term for absolute power, the right hand of God, and has come back right when he said he would at the end of that generation, and is here on this earth ruling and reigning. Where is he? You can't see him. Is this because you're all fleshed out? You think that the second coming has to do with a 6-foot-tall physical Jewish carpenter up in the sky. He is physical, but he is glorified. He's in his raised body, but it's glorified. See, it's the exception from death, and he's the only one that had the exception. That's why he has a body. That's why our body, resurrected, which we'll deal with next time, comes out of heaven, because flesh and blood cannot go into heaven, 1 Corinthians 15:50. You can say it's raised out of the ground and glorified all you want, but it's still flesh and blood. It's still the basis of flesh. It is unacceptable, the carbon-based body, unacceptable for living in heaven. You see, Jesus, it's one or the other. He's either crazy and a lunatic, or a deceiver, same category, or he's exactly who he said he was. So what are you going to do with Jesus today? What are you going to do with Jesus today? Are you going to leave this place in the same condition that you were in when you arrived? I'm asking you. What are you going to do with Jesus? He doesn't just go away. See? And here's the part of the sermon. You know, and you know, I have a teaching ministry. I like to let the Word, you know, lean into us, right? Now I'm pressing you, because today it's like, just press. I'm pressing. I'm not calling anybody's salvation into question, okay? You know if you have a relationship with God through Christ or not. You also know if you're walking in rebellion with Him. You also know these things. You also know if you're playing around. You know all these things. What are you going to do with Jesus today? Jesus said to the Laodicean church in the book of Revelation, 3rd chapter, 21st verse, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man will hear my voice," and you've been listening to his voice today. You've been listening to it. "If any man will hear my voice and open the door, I'll come into him and I'll have table fellowship with him and he with me." What do we do with Jesus today? Well, Lord God, we just give you praise and thanks for all that you've taught us today, Lord God, in this short encounter between your Son and the Pharisees and the Herodians. Lord God, hide this word deep inside of us. Give us further illumination, O Lord, in what you are teaching us here. May we not forget the things that we have heard, O God, and may we apply them to our lives, O Father, in the name of Jesus Christ. How we love you, how we praise you, and thank you for these things. Let thy word, like you said in John, the 17th chapter, "Let thy word be truth." And it is. Thy word is truth. It is my truth. May each of us be able to say the same thing, that the word is my truth. And we thank you for this today, O God. Father, as we